It is a warm August night in 1920, the scrublands south of Los Angeles. 10,000 people standing in a field, looking up into a black sky. They came because someone told them a man was going to climb into a biplane, take it up to 4,000 feet in the dark, and dive it back toward Earth in a tight spiral while searchlights chased him down. They paid to see that. They are about to get more than they bargained for. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Tonight, we're going back to the loudest, most reckless, most genuinely alive chapter of American aviation history, the barnstorming era, and to the one man who embodied everything that era stood for and paid the highest price for it. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. Ormer Leslie Locklear was born in Greenville, Texas, in 1891. Cotton country hard, flat working country, the kind of place where a boy grew up knowing how to fix things with his hands, how to make do, how to solve problems that didn't come with a manual. Locklear was mechanically inclined from the start. Engines made sense to him the way music makes sense to certain people. Intuitive, natural. And he was, by every account from the people who knew him, completely without fear. Not reckless. There is a difference, and it matters enormously to this story. Not reckless, without fear. When the United States entered the First World War in 1917, Locklear enlisted and was sent to Camp Taliaferro near Fort Worth for flight training. The Army needed pilots the way they needed artillery shells, fast and in enormous quantity. They poured young men through training programs as quickly as instructors could manage. The aircraft they trained on was the Curtiss JN-4, the Jenny. A two-seat biplane with a 90-horsepower OX-5 engine, fabric-covered wings, and a smell that any pilot from that era would recognize in an instant. Hot oil and exhaust and the sharp chemical bite of dope drying on linen. The Jenny topped out around 70 or 75 miles per hour. It was not a fighter. It was not a fracer. It was not a racer. It was a trainer. Docile, slow, forgiving. But for the young men climbing into cockpits for the first time in 1917 and 18, that Jenny was everything. Locklear became an instructor, which meant he was better than most. He could fly, and he could teach others to fly. And those are two different skills that don't always live in the same person. But he was restless in the way that gifted people sometimes are when the work isn't pushing back hard enough. Now here's where it gets interesting. The story of how Ormer Locklear invented wing walking has been told in a few different ways over the years. The small details shift depending on which account you read, but the core of it is the same. One day while Locklear was aloft in his Jenny somewhere over the Texas fields, something came loose on the aircraft, a fuel cap, a small fitting, something that was going to become a problem if it was ignored. The sensible response would have been to land the airplane, walk over to the offending part, and fix it with both feet on the ground. Ormer Locklear did not land the airplane. He throttled back, climbed out of the cockpit, walked out along the wing of a moving aircraft, and fixed the problem. Then he walked back to the cockpit and landed. He did not fall. He did not panic. He simply did it. The way you might step out onto a ledge to adjust something on the wall, except the ledge is moving at 60 miles per hour, and there is nothing below it but Texas sky. When he climbed back in and landed, he understood something. He had just discovered, through pure pragmatic necessity, that a human being with sufficient balance and nerve could exist on the wing of a flying airplane, not just survive it, act deliberately, work. He started practicing. Quietly at first, then less quietly, words spread around the field. Pilots and ground crew gathered to watch. The Army was not overjoyed about any of this, but Locklear had found something that had no precedent, and there was no closing that door. The armistice came in November of 1918 and changed everything. The country had trained something approaching 11,000 flyers. The war was over. The Army had no need for most of them, and the government held a surplus of aircraft that had nowhere useful to go. Curtiss Jennys flooded the civilian market. You could buy one for a few hundred dollars, sometimes less. The sky was suddenly full of young men with flight experience, no employment, and a machine that could take them anywhere the fuel held out. This was the birth of the barnstorming era. The word barnstorming actually came from itinerant theater troupes that performed in rural barns before anybody had an airplane. The pilots borrowed the word because the life was similar. You moved from town to town. You set up wherever you could find open ground. You performed. You moved on. These pilots flew their Jennys across rural America and landed in farmers' fields. With permission when they could get it, and without when they couldn't, they'd set up a hand-lettered sign near the road. Airplane rides. $5. Sometimes one pilot would buzz the main street of a nearby town at low altitude, throttle wide open, rattling windows and sending chickens in every direction, just to let people know something was happening out in Henderson's field, and they ought to come see it. The people came, farmers and schoolteachers and storekeepers and their children, people who had read about airplanes in the newspaper and never expected to see one in their lifetimes, let alone touch one. They came in wagons and in Model Ts and on horseback and on foot. They paid their $5 and climbed into the front cockpit of a Jenny and rose above everything they had ever known. Something happens to a person the first time they leave the Earth that doesn't quite unhappen afterward. The Barnstormers understood that. They were selling something that nobody had ever sold before, not just a ride, a first look at your own life from above.
But rides alone didn't fill a field with 10,000 people. You needed something more, a draw, something that made a man or a woman drive 10 miles on a dirt road when there was still work to be done. So the pilots began performing loops, rolls, low passes at full throttle that rattled the teeth, inverted flight. These were things that 1919 audiences had never seen. The appetite for them was enormous, but Ormer Locklear offered something that nobody else in the country was offering. He built his post-war act with two partners, Shirley Short, who flew the aircraft below him, and Milton Skeets Elliott, who became Locklear's closest friend and constant companion in the air. The three of them built something together that defied any existing category. Locklear did not just walk the wings. He hung from the landing gear by his hands with his body fully in the slipstream. He stood on his head on the top wing at 1,000 feet. He walked out to the wingtip and held his position while the aircraft banked and maneuvered beneath him, and he performed the stunt that made him truly famous across the country. He transferred between two aircraft, in flight, one biplane flying in close formation with another, and Locklear stepping deliberately from the wing of one to the wing of the other, while both machines were moving and the crowd below held its breath in a single, unbroken silence. Shirley Short, flying beneath him, had to feel every shift in Locklear's weight. Every movement across the wing changed the load distribution, changed the pitch and roll response of the aircraft, and Short had to compensate for every one of those changes with her hands and feet, silently, continuously, reading the airplane as Locklear read the air around him. The two of them were operating at the absolute limit of what physics would allow, and they were doing it in perfect, unspoken coordination. What most of the crowd never understood was that what they were watching was not recklessness. It was precision. It was a man who had studied every load path on the wing surface, every change in airflow at different air speeds, every way his body weight shifted the balance of the machine beneath him, and who had practiced until his understanding was in his muscles instead of his head. Reckless men died fast in aviation in those years. Locklear survived because he knew exactly what he was doing, every moment at every altitude. By 1919, he was nationally famous, not aviation famous, nationally famous. His name appeared in newspapers from New York to San Francisco. Promoters competed to book him. Crowds turned out in numbers that would fill a baseball stadium. He was, in a very real way, the first aviation celebrity the country had ever produced, which is exactly when Hollywood came looking. Universal Pictures signed Locklear to star in a feature film called The Great Air Robbery. It was a silent action picture built entirely around aerial stunts. Locklear and Short and Elliott performed every sequence themselves. No stunt doubles, no trick photography. Whatever the camera captured was real. The film was released in 1919 and was a genuine success. Universal immediately put Locklear into a second production. They called it The Skywayman. And that is how we arrive at that August night in 1920, 10,000 people in a field outside Los Angeles looking up at a dark sky. The scene the production needed required Locklear to fly up to altitude after dark and dive in a tight spiral toward the Earth. Searchlights would track him on the way down. The plan, as it was communicated to him, was that the searchlights would cut off at a certain point, giving Locklear the clear dark horizon. He needed to judge his pullout altitude and recover from the dive in time. The searchlights did not cut off, whether it was a miscommunication, a missed cue, or simple human error on the ground. The lights stayed on through the entire descent. Locklear came spiraling down, completely blinded by the beams that were supposed to help him, and he never found the horizon. He and Skeets Elliott, flying with him that night, struck the earth at full speed and were killed instantly. Ormer Locklear was 28 years old.
They brought him home to Fort Worth. The crowds that came out for the funeral were the kind you see for generals and presidents. The barnstorming era kept going after him. It had its own momentum, but it was already beginning to carry the weight of its own costs. Wingwalkers and stunt pilots died with regularity through the early 1920s. The public appetite for danger was almost unlimited, and the margin for error never was. In 1926, the Air Commerce Act brought federal regulation to American aviation for the first time. beginning the slow, necessary process of bringing structure to the chaos that had made barnstorming both extraordinary and deadly. The Gennies aged out. The crowds who had never seen an airplane in their lives became the older generation. The era simply ran out of road. What Ormer Locklear left behind was larger than any stunt on any list of stunts. He was the first person to demonstrate that the sky was not just a medium you moved through, that a human body, trained and precise and steady, could inhabit that space beyond the cockpit. Every airshow performer who came after him, every wingwalker, every low pass that makes a crowd go quiet, every pilot who built a career out of making danger look like grace, traces something back to a farm kid from Greenville, Texas, who one afternoon climbed out of his cockpit to fix a loose fitting and found out what he was put on Earth to do. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram archives and the film history documentation of Locklear's Universal Pictures productions are good starting points if you want to go deeper. Aviation historian Dan Hagedorn's work on the barnstorming era is thorough and worth tracking down. You can find more at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger. See you next time.